It's essentially defined by three main characteristics. So significant restriction of energy intake that leads to dramatic weight loss. Secondly, an intense fear around gaining weight, even when your weight might be significantly low. And the third sort of factor that would be involved in a diagnosis of anorexia nervosa is experience of one's body shape or a disturbance in the way one's body weight and shape is sort of perceived and experienced.
It's such a striking mental illness, and you see these pictures of people that have, you know, gone right to the edge, and it's sort of, I've heard before that they don't really see themselves going in that direction until it's too late. Is that the case?
I think it varies, and I think for many of us, we might be able to perhaps recall a memory of someone who we could see in our community who always wore black clothes and always sort of, you could see them walking around the community. And, you know, I think just last year there was a case of a woman who is sort of known as the walking woman in the Northern Territory of Australia who very sadly died from the illness.
Why was she known as the walking woman?
Well, she just walked all the time, all around her community. So I think it is a striking illness. Visually, it is striking and can be quite distressing to see somebody in that sort of state of unwellness, where you can see somebody persisting with something that, from your own point of view, is clearly very harmful. People's with anorexia nervosa, their degree of insight into their illness really varies quite a lot. You know, the typical age onset of someone with anorexia nervosa is quite young, and most people recover from the illness while still young, sort of in their adolescent years. But I suppose the longer somebody has the illness, the more complicated their insight into the illness can be because of long-term effects on the brain from starvation.
And the more intensive the treatment program as well, I assume.
Yes and no. There's more evidence for treatment success when a person hasn't been unwell for too long. So what you often see is a much more active approach to treatment when clinicians are working with adolescents or with people who haven't experienced the illness or been diagnosed with the illness for long, because generally speaking, you're more likely to get a better treatment outcome the less somebody has been unwell. The longer somebody stays unwell, the harder it is to treat and the less treatment interventions there are to offer. So at that point, it becomes really tricky for clinicians to decide, what do I have to offer here? How can I compel somebody into treatment?
And I guess that leads us to this idea of involuntary treatment, which is what I really wanted to get into today. What does that look like?
So typically, if an adolescent is refusing treatment, clinicians would look to parents to sort of consent to treatment on the adolescent's behalf. With adults, there is nobody who can consent on their behalf most of the time, and so that's a different story. So there's two sort of pieces of legislation that cover the use of involuntary treatment in New South Wales. The Mental Health Act is one, and guardianship legislation can also be used. So in a public hospital system, for example, if somebody comes into an emergency department displaying symptoms of that look like an eating disorder, you know, severely malnourished, perhaps they're having cardiac problems, it's determined that the person needs to be seen by a psychiatrist because that person has an eating disorder. Either the person's told them that themselves or somebody who's brought them in can tell them that. And then I guess there needs to be a decision, okay, around whether or not this person needs to be kept in the hospital and receive treatment. And if that person is refusing that, then a decision needs to be made about whether or not there's grounds to hold that person in the hospital against their will.
How do you keep someone in a hospital against their will?
There are public hospitals that contain locked wards, and within those wards, there are patients that are there voluntarily. And, you know, in exceptional circumstances, in limited number of cases, there are also people that are there involuntarily as well.
Are we talking about being forcibly given medication, being forced to eat? What sort of processes go into that, I guess, if you're comfortable talking about it?
Yeah, I mean, there's a range of things that may be considered for somebody with severe anorexia nervosa. So if somebody has been malnourished and barely eaten for a really long period of time, there are actually dangers involved in refeeding that person. It needs to be really closely monitored. There are significant harms to that person that could be caused without that monitoring. So in some instances, if a person is refusing to eat and they could die as a result of that decision, people can be fed through a tube, and that might be something that's called for in severe cases. But if that's not called for, what would ideally happen is there'd be some level of collaboration between the patient and the treating team, that a certain sort of meal plan needs to be followed, and that would be, as I said, closely sort of supervised within that treatment environment.
It blows my mind that there's so many variables involved, you know, like not only is each patient unique, but the competence, beliefs, and even professionalism of every person involved in the decision-making and treatment process can vary just based on human nature. How can we ensure that each individual patient who may need involuntary treatment receives the best possible care?
You make a good point. It is extremely complex, particularly for those adults who may have had the illness for a long time. And most professionals working in this field would make a sort of a distinction between, you know, severe chronic patients or patients who present with very severe and acute symptoms of the illness, as opposed to, say, catching somebody in their a much younger patient who maybe hasn't been unwell for so long that their symptoms are so awful. It is fraught, and there is a lack of consensus within the professional community around involuntary treatment and when it's justified. So certainly there would be clinicians in the field that say you should never give up hope that a patient might recover, and therefore, you know, involuntary treatment to preserve life is always justified. You know, there have been cases where a treating team who has known a patient for a long time, and where literally every single treatment intervention has been tried and hasn't worked, in agreement with the patient, it is possible to sort of come to a decision sometimes that the quality of life of this person isn't going to be improved by involuntary treatment, that the clinical team does not have treatment to offer, and that person, it might be determined that that person shouldn't be forced to stay in hospital and receive treatment against their will. So a lot of these decisions are, to a degree, arbitrary. It becomes a professional call at some point to say, you know, we have tried everything. You know, you shouldn't compel somebody against their will unless you can say with a degree of certainty that what you're going to do is going to do them good. And on top of that, that it shouldn't do them harm. And there is no cure for anorexia nervosa. So there's lots of treatment methods that are shown to work. And certainly, as I said before, the earlier patients receive treatment, much better outcomes. So we're really talking about a small group of patients where it becomes this complicated.
Just to wrap up, best case scenario, what would you like to see, I guess, change about treatment practices over the next few years?
So more research in this area, I think, will be a great thing for informing new treatment responses. I think listening to people's experiences as well of treatment is also valuable. And there is, again, more research around that sort of reports on patient experiences and the things that actually make a difference to people. They might be things that are hard to find evidence for, but they are things that patients retrospectively can say, well, that was the thing that helped me. So patients talk a lot about the impact of their relationships with staff as something that has helped them to get through treatment, whether it be involuntary or voluntary.